Well, you can say hi if you want to.
Hi, this is
Howdy.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Greg LeMond. Welcome to the VeloCast.
That's nice, really nice, yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the VeloCast. Coming up this week, does Daniel Tekla Hymenot going to Cofidis mean we might have to pay them some attention this year? Will Galopin nabbing Atoile de Bessèges mean that he's off Marc Serrault's Christmas card list? What does Chavez returning to the top step in Australia mean for the Giro? And is cycling's new top-hatted, black-cape-wearing, moustache-twirling pantomime villain announcing his first race of 2018 best for cycling? But first, and the irony of this really can't be stressed enough, former top-hatted, black-cape-wearing, moustache-twirling pantomime villain turned Benjamin Button-esque darling of the cycling world, Alejandro Valverde, has not only returned to racing, but has come back almost as strong as he ever was by winning the 2018 edition of the Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana. Well, as you do.
Easy for you to say, mate.
Yeah, it's one of those races that just trips off the tongue, isn't it? It might do if you're from the Iberian Peninsula, but I'm not, as is very, very clear.
Lovely kit that Movie Star have got this year, isn't it?
It is.
An absolutely beautiful kit. And, you know, when he was away in that decisive break that I think set the, you know, set the stage for his overall victory with the two Astana colours, it was just a fantastic day for anybody who's a fan of the colour blue.
Oh, I was going to actually thought you were meaning the fantastic new kit that Movie Star have got is that pale blue of Astana, because there were times it looked like Astana were leading out their new signing for 2019, Alejandro Valverde.
It's amazing, actually. I mean, last year when he injured himself, hitting that barrier in the Tour, that horrible injury where he smashed his kneecap to bits and broke his talus bone, we genuinely said at the time this could be career ending. And, you know, we weren't alone. A huge number of people said that, because he's not getting any younger. What is he, 37 now?
Well, and again, in Benjamin Button years, does that not make him 22 and therefore at the start of his career? Yeah.
But, you know, we saw the tales of him training hard over the winter, and we heard him say, my numbers are good, the people that I train with say I'm back to my former level. But of course you don't know until you actually start racing. There's a lot of difference between being able to train well and actually being able to race. And what we saw in this race was vintage Valverde, you know, forcing the attack, working with brakes, and then, you know, being able just to clinically finish off a sprint, because he's one of the best sprinters after a hard effort amongst, you know, potential GC guys. I think he looks every bit as strong as last year. And last year we saw him perform at a very high level from very early on in the season through to a Tour where, quite genuinely, I was talking about him as a possible contender, and some people I know had actually picked him as a winner for that Tour based on his performances throughout the year. And I think we're looking at, you know, rinse and repeat this year. He looked incredibly strong.
Especially that stage four that he won, his winner of two stages at this race. But stage four, in fairness, I mean, that finishing climb, it could have been any more perfect if he himself had not only designed it, but actually went and built the climb for him to race up. But the way that he finished that off was, I mean, it was perfection. Again, kind of laying out the cliches, he couldn't have scripted it any better. It was a fantastic day's racing to watch. But as I say, that finale up, that brutal, brutal finish was just archetypal Alejandro Valverde.
Yeah, attacking at just the right point. And when he was away with the two Astana guys, Fuglsang and Sanchez, he was so imperious that almost immediately I thought he was clearly going to win the stage, even with two guys from the same, you know, the same team against him. In fairness, Sanchez himself was looking just as delighted as Alejandro Valverde for the win. You know, for Valverde to come back, he's clearly a popular character in the peloton. But, you know, you'd be a fool to bet against him for certainly another Liège, Amstel, Flèche Wallonne, you know, all of that stuff. Just expect Alejandro to perform at the very highest level. And if you're, you know, say some small Colombian chap whose name's Nairo, already you're thinking, oh God, here we go again. you know, because he looks in the kind of form, and I know it's early in the season and he might have peaked too soon, he looks in the kind of form where he might again have the best season of his career at the age of 37. I mean, what a guy!
Oh, if only I could send that little nugget of audio back in time to 2009 or 2010 where you were...
God, my blood vessels would burst if you sent me saying that back in time.
I also want to talk just specifically about that stage four, because I thought Adam Yates also looked fantastic, attacking more times than I think that anybody could count. And each time you're thinking... Or that's it, you know, he's done for now. We'll probably see him pop out the back of that group because the pace that's being set by ostensibly the two Astana riders dragging him back in and trying to keep the pace high enough that Valverde couldn't attack, but was for naught as it turned out. But as I say, I thought Adam Yates was superb on the day. Sadly, I think for him, in the final throes of the stage itself, or the final throes of that climb, simply provided the carrot for Alejandro to go and hunt for and be the launching pad for his ultimate win that day.
Well, I think we're going to talk about Chavez making a return to winning ways later in the show. And I think Mitchelson and Scott have got a really nice team coming together. You know, they've stuck with the Yates brothers. The Yates brothers have stuck with them. You know, it's a mutually beneficial arrangement. And they're developing into riders that nobody can allow to go up the road. You know, they could easily take a big win if, you know, somebody hesitates and lets them get 30 seconds where they shouldn't. You add to that a Chavez, who is a proven performer in Grand Tours, who just has to get the first one under his belt, which it wouldn't surprise me at all if it was the Giro this year, you know, after he came so close before being ninja'd by Vincenzo Nibali the other year. And I think Mitchelton Scott have got a lot to be optimistic about. And Adam Yates in particular, I think he had a great year last year. I think we could see him move on to even greater heights in 2018.
And only, 9 seconds off finishing on the overall general classification podium this year. So, I mean, it's a great start to the season for him. I mean, you've mentioned that Astana duo, who, of course, finished second and third in GC at this race. So what had been probably a fairly dire 2017 for Astana, because... looking into 2018, you're kind of thinking, where do we go from here with this team? But it's starting to kind of come together more for Astana looking ahead to this season.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they've lost a lot of people who were the obvious people to step up for GC. When you look at Fabio Aru, for example, you know, he was an obvious contender. But the team themselves seem to have a bit of depth this year, and they seem to have a bit of teamwork going. Fuglsang was really strong last year. I think he needs to step up. And I think Astana, although they'll be disappointed they didn't take the victory, you know, Alessandro Valverde had stated that his target was the victory. He's managed his goals. Astana will be a wee bit disappointed that they weren't able to give him a harder time of it. But as a team, I think they'll come out of it looking very, very well. The other thing I think is worthy of comment is the same can't be, you know, said of Team Sky, I think. I think Team Sky had a really disappointing race.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were looking to this race to see how certain riders from Sky were going to come to the fore, and it just didn't happen. In fact, the highest finishing Sky rider was another pantomime villain, Gianni Moscon, who showed that he's not just a rider for sprinting. That, you know, coming in 12th, only a minute 13 down on riders like Valverde and Luis Leon Sanchez, Jakob Fuglsang, Adam Yates, shows that he can hang there. And again, coming back to that stage four, when we were expecting someone like Wout Poels to be hanging on that lead group, Wout Poels disappeared very, very quickly. Yeah. And although Moscon eventually did kind of falter, I think he came back to the group at one point and then faltered when the pace came up. It was actually encouraging putting aside his personal issues, encouraging from a young rider's point of view to see him be able to hang in there in terrain that doesn't necessarily suit him from what we've seen of the rider thus far. And I think it goes towards a rider who maybe, you know, I guess not like Peter Sagan a few years ago, maybe just didn't know what he's capable of doing yet. So it'll be interesting to watch. I mean, if he can keep the heat and not manage to get himself banned from cycling completely, it would be worth following what his development actually is.
Or put in jail for grievous bodily harm.
Well, yes, quite. Yeah.
Actually, the thing about Moscone that I like, and I mean, people have heard me rant about, you know, the things that annoyed me about him at the end of last year. The thing about Moscone that I really, really like is the same thing that I like about Alejandro Valverde now, and the thing I like about Petr Sagan is he is willing to take a race by the scruff of the neck. You know, there was a crash that left him out in front where, you know, a lesser rider would have said, actually, I'll just hang on. I'm not quite good enough to go for it. And he just put the hammer down to try and make a difference. So, yep, he seems to be a bit of an idiot. He's done things, allegedly, which are extremely harmful to the image of the sport and to other people, actually, physically. But damn, the guy can race. So, you know, 5 years from now, I may be the same as I am now with Valverde, and I'll have forgotten all of Moscone's foibles, and I'll just love him as a racer. Because I'm that inconsistent.
You are, clearly. Another team I think we need to mention coming out looking strong from this race is BMC. Won the time trial, I beg your pardon, the team time trial during the week.
Didn't get me started about that.
Well, I'm asking you to get started about it. But also we need to make mention of Jürgen Roelandts winning the final day's sprint. And one of those riders that is going to, I'm sure you agree, is going to take me a while to get used to in a BMC kit, because you're going, when did that move happen? Jürgen Roelandts at BMC? Yeah,
and the same with Danny Van Poppel moving away from Sky. Yeah. I mean, that's doing my head in this week. Roelandts, I think it's his first victory of any sort since 2012, because he's always been one of those guys who's had to put himself at the service of others in, you know, a classics-oriented team. And the move to BMC, I think, was as much for his personal ambition to get some freedom before the end of his career. And it's clearly working. You know, he beat Danny Van Poppel in that sprint in BMC colours. And I've got to admit, it took me a couple of minutes to work out who it was, for the very reason you've just said. We're at that stage in the season where the strips are still unfamiliar. We'll get used to it, but not yet. And Danny Van Poppel and Jürgen Roelandts are the two this week who really confounded me seeing them in different kit.
Okay, we need to tackle that team time trial, because it was contentious, basically because of the weather. But I'll allow you to expound on that.
It even had me disagreeing with Laura Messiger, and I never disagree with Laura Messiger. You know, she's one of the best journalists working in cycling just now. And, you know, she tweeted that the organisers had suspended the GC element of the day's team time trial because of the weather. And I, with my usual tact and restraint, said, that's stupid. And Laura quite rightly came back and said, well, you know, it's different when you're going full gas, which sounds like an excuse. But it isn't. You know, if it's hard enough conditions that you are having to suspend an element of the race, then I would argue it's too hard to allow people to race. If you can ride it safely, then it's raceable. And it's that simple. And we had no incidents whatsoever, largely because the weather improved a wee bit, but also because these guys are professional bike riders, and part of their job is dealing with the conditions in the road. You know, if every time something looked slightly dodgy, bearing in mind nobody wants people to be injured, we cancelled stuff, you would never race down, you know, Sermano or any of these risky descents, because somebody might get hurt. Now, in close formation in a team time trial, in bad weather, the risks are there. But what you do is you just ride a wee bit further apart. You know, you ride to the conditions, and that's part of the skill of cycling. And for the GC guys to not have to deal with those conditions, when people were able to race incredibly fast, very safely, in the way that BMC did, I think took away from the GC a wee bit. I think it would have pushed Alejandro Valverde just that wee bit harder. It would have forced Movistar to burn a few more matches to keep him in contention. And you can bet when those organisers neutralised that stage for GC, the biggest sigh of relief was from Alejandro Valverde. I just think it basically comes down to, if it's safe enough to ride, it's safe enough to race. And if you can ride fast on the day to win the stage, why suspend the GC? It seemed absolutely insane to me.
No, I would have to agree with all of that. If one element of the competition is being suspended, especially when the entire competition is based on that element which is being suspended, time, then it just makes a mockery of the overall result. You'd be as well just not having the stage at all. And yeah, that way everybody can feel that You know, the time that was ridden on that final day is actually the time that everybody gained, lost, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I'll be completely clear. I wouldn't have complained if they'd cancelled the stage said, we'll just have a parade. It's the middle ground where they decide that one element is fine to race for and they'll leave the decision to the individual team. But UGC guys can have a nice wee rest today. It was a farce. I really didn't agree with it at all.
Well, also back to winning ways this week is Esteban Chavez. The Colombian's 2017 season was marred by the knee injury and subsequent broken shoulder that left the 28-year-old without a single win. However, the Mitchelson Scott rider has set out his stall for the Grand Tours to come with an impressive win at the Herald Sun Tour.
Yeah, Chavez seems to really have adopted the Aussie culture. You know, he's fitted into that team superbly well. And the team have supported him. I mean, we've seen Orica Greenedge in their day turn themselves inside out for Chavez. And he's rewarded them with some fantastic victories, you know, the Tour of Lombardy, that great second in the Giro. And at some point, he has to take a big win. And I think this will give him the confidence to build on this season after the difficulty he had last year, you know, with injury and bad form or whatever. So I think it's a good indicator. You know, a lot of folk are mentioning that victories in Australia have often been the platform for Chris Froome to build to, you know, greatness in the Grand Tours later in the year. And Chavez will be aware of that. So, you know, he won't be thinking I've peaked too soon or anything. He'll be looking at the fact the team came together to support him for the victory and he was able to finish it off and reward them for that hard work. So great for his confidence. And who doesn't love seeing the wee guy win something? I mean, he's just such an asset to the sport with his cheerfulness. He's, you know, he's always willing to be interviewed or give a quote to somebody. And he just beams enjoyment. So I'm pleased to see him back. He's one of my favourite riders. And, you know, I said earlier when we were talking about Yates, I think that team are going to do well this year. I think he's going to play a big part in that.
Only for balance and nothing more than that. Because like yourself, I love seeing Esteban Chavez winning or even just racing well. He's just such a happy, smiley guy, it would seem, all the time. He's great in interviews, he's great on the road. But just your comment regarding Chris Froome and using Australian racing to build for the Grand Tours. I think for every Chris Froome, there's also a Richie Port. So maybe just take it easy, Esteban. Don't get too carried away, mate.
Well, I think we may see Richie move up this year.
No,
as well.
I know. It was for the gag, if nothing else.
I tell you the other thing is, how good is it? How good is it to see Edmondson in the national champions jersey? That family bring a lot to cycling in Australia, and to see, you know, the Australian national champs jersey on the back of Nettie Edmondson's brother brings a smile to my face.
And sorry, just going back to some contentious action, we've got to talk about the neutralisation of the gravel sector.
See, this is where you'd expect me, because, you know, I love the Pave, I love the Strada Bianchi, I love all that gravel stuff. And I feel it brings a real element of uncertainty and a need for a new set of skills to the peloton. So these races, and, you know, when the Giro goes over the unpaved passes, they all add something to the race. But I think in this case, they had no option about where to go because of these roadworks. In Milan San Remo, we've seen with landslides and stuff, they have to alter the course. It happens all over the world in cycling. You know, because it is about dealing with what's in front of you in the real world. It's not about a velodrome and the controlled conditions there. So they had to take the diversion. I think we were looking forward to, I think some of the riders were looking forward to a section of that pave, or rather that Strada Bianchi-like surface, where they might be able to make a difference. But Chavez himself said that once they broke through the surface, because it had been so dry, you know, there was no compaction underneath, and essentially they were cycling on dust. So in this case, I think it was exactly the right decision to neutralise it. It was so far out from the finish that it wasn't going to be that decisive. It was likely all going to come together anyway, because they were still, 110k for the finish? Mm. So I think to reduce the risk in this case and neutralise that section was the right decision. But hopefully, you know, it'll give them some ideas for future editions, and they'll get water trucks in, you know, to bed it in before the race gets there and actually introduce it as a feature as opposed to, you know, an ad hoc correction for a bit of roadworks.
Well, he may have found himself in 15th place at the start of the final TT stage, but the 20-second deficit was more than easily overturned as Tony Galopin took the 2018 Étoile de Bessèges, leaving two-time stage winner and overnight leader Marc Serrault to tumble down to 9th.
Marc Serrault, I mean, clearly he's absolutely pants as a tester, but what a sprinter. You know, he beat some serious people. So a great, great introduction for a rider that I'd heard of but hadn't looked at in depth to me. So for two victories, great. But Tony Gallagher, he's a classy rider, you know, and this, for me, is more an indication of the kind of form he's going to be in when we get to his terrain, you know, his preferred terrain in the classics. So it'll be a big confidence booster for Galopin. But Serrault, he's got very little to be ashamed of after taking two stages in this race against, you know, really, really good folk like Brian Coquard. Good sprinters against him, and he still took home the victories. Well done, lad.
Yeah, definitely that. And if nothing else, once again, kind of underpins this unfortunate statistic that we keep bringing up. It seems that the French canny time trial for toffee.
Yeah, I mean, and they are getting better at it. I mean, we've seen folk like Bardet pay attention, although he's still woeful against the clock compared to some of his big competitors. But when you look at the French great, you know, grown tour riders, all of them could test. You know, the worst of them as a tester was probably Laurent Fignon, and he was bloody good. Eno in his day was one of the best time trialists in the world. Jacques Anquetil, what's he famous for? Being able to time trial. So what we have now is a nation who can produce exciting racers, a nation who can produce riders who are capable of climbing like angels when they need to. Riders who can descend like a stone. We've seen that from Bardet so often. I notice actually he's injured himself in a household accident just now. So he's got his arm in a big kind of, it's not a stookie, it's a supportive bandage or something, isn't it?
Yeah, it called it, and this may be one of those things that gets lost in translation, a domestic incident. I mean, that's a big, big arena to be playing in. Where are we going with that?
Were dogs involved? Kitchen knives?
Who knows? the list of comedy accidents that could be at the root of this are legion. And if he's not going to actually tell us specifically what it is, he is leaving himself open to all manner of suggestion. So, Mr. Bardet, how did you get your thumb stuck up there?
Bizarre gardening accident.
Exactly that.
It's, getting back to the point, though, I think you're spot on, is we have a nation of the French riders who are amongst the best we've seen since the likes of Eno and Fignon, but who just don't have that last element that will turn them into the very, very greats of Grand Tour riders. And they are getting better, you know, because the whole marginal gains thing, where they're spending time in their time trial bikes, they're going into wind tunnels, is making them better. But if Serrault could have time trialled, he would have, you know, it would have been a lot more than two really nice stage wins for him. But clearly, he's pants at it.
And to the race itself, I mean, it's one of those races that has been over, well, goodness knows how long, been kind of declining in stature, and it's still a great race. And of course, it's such a French race. I'm just looking at the final GC there. I think it's, several million places down before you get to somebody who isn't French.
Oh, and if you look at the teams, it's Cofidis, Delco Marseille, Agidor. I mean, it's clearly a holiday for the French teams. I mean, it's really deep. Just as the other week I said to you, it's amazing how many Australians have placed well in the Australian races. This is a French race.
Yeah, but I mean, it's one of those ones, as I say, that has kind of lost. Its name probably suggests a bigger race than it actually is these days, if you know what I mean. There's people still think of the Étoile de Bessèges and it being a big race, but it's not actually drawing the no disrespect, of course, to the likes of Galopin or Sylvain Chavanel, you know, Lilian Calmejane, a whole ton of great French talent that come to this race, but it's not attracting international talent.
No, and you can guarantee it wouldn't have been on Galopin's goal list. You know, he's won it because he had a decent time trial on the day and he didn't make any big mistakes. It's one of those races, and I'm sad to say this, where you really wouldn't be surprised if one year you discovered that, you know, it was in the realm of Killian and it disappeared from the roads of France. You know, we've lost so many of these good, used to be mid-level, but now dropping down a wee bit races that, you know, the Étoile de Bessage could easily go that way. But, I mean, it sounds like it was cracking racing. And as I say, for Galopin, going into the classic season, big boost for his confidence.
Well, we have tried to maintain a dignified silence, dear listener. Lord knows we've tried. While the rest of the cycling world has wailed, gnashed its teeth and clickbaited its way through baseless, ignorant supposition masquerading as insight and analysis, we here at Velocast Towers decided that, having covered the Chris Froome situation when the news was first announced, we'd actually not talk about it again until more actual news was forthcoming. A radical idea, I grant you, these days. However, whilst nothing concrete has been revealed regarding the ongoing investigation into Froome's adverse analytical finding, news announced today that the multiple Grand Tour winner is to commence his 2018 season at the Ruta del Sol next week behooves us to discuss the Schrodinger's elephant in the middle of the room in a box inside an Escher painting or something. Look, I don't know. We're going to have to discuss it.
Everybody's got an opinion, and I'm not going to throw the old saw about what the other thing that everybody has is. But everybody's got their opinion about the Chris Froome. Whether he's guilty or innocent is not what's at stake here, or not what we're going to discuss, unless you want to. But, you know, as you say, we've been trying to avoid this because with no new information, you're just adding speculation upon speculation. I want to say, though, I would really, really like it if he wasn't riding before this thing is cleared up. Not because I think he should be banned or any of that kind of stuff. Just because it makes our job absolutely horrible every time he throws a leg over the top tube to ride a race. Because with the elephant in the room, you know, that sword of Damocles of the potential suspension hanging over his head, it just means that it's actually going to detract from the racing itself. Because there will be this foundation, this undercurrent of suspicion, this undercurrent of what's going to happen. Is he going to be sanctioned? If he's sanctioned, what will happen to any results he gets while he's racing prior to the issue being resolved? It's not good for Chris because, you know, folk are going to be talking about him in a pejorative fashion all the time while he's trying to focus on racing. It's not good for the races because the race organisers are potentially in a situation where somebody who does very, very well in one of their events might be retroactively, you know, stripped of any results they get. And it's not good for cycling because it's just that drip, drip, drip of suspicion writ large every single day, and it's really shite for podcasters because we have to talk about this crap.
Well, you've kind of, you know, centred a lot of what you've said there on a lot of what has been written, and one of the things that I kind of wanted to address and talk about, and I'll be honest, I find this argument of he should self-suspend on the grounds of, and I quote, it would be the best for cycling, to be nothing short of astounding. And I warn you in advance.
I don't even have an opinion on that.
I know, but I mean, you've laid it out as to why people are taking that line, you know, this sword of Damocles, as you put it, hanging over his head. So I'm not addressing you, just the mountain of articles and opinion that have been published over the past few weeks. And this may take a wee bit of time. So,
well, go put the kettle on.
Well, I was just going to say, since you're only interested in the sound of your own voice, John, I suggest that you maybe go put the kettle on or catch up on your Netflix queue or whatever it is you do when you're not here pretending to listen to me.
I'll just take my headphones off and watch the waveforms so I know when you've stopped.
Well, I'm going to try and play devil's advocate here and kind of maybe look at the thinking inherent in this self-suspending business. First off, there's, you know, if journalists are going to argue, as we've seen in these opinion pieces recently, for moral action based on what's best for cycling, then doesn't that suggest that the leak should never have been published? And as per the regulations we currently have, adverse analytical findings for specified substances don't get made public, as the athlete has the right to investigation and explanation. And of course, people are going to say, well, the press has a duty to publish, and that's absolutely fine. I said that back at the point this did come to light. But I think it's bizarre that journalists should then complain that we do now know contrary to what the procedure actually is, and that the rider has to do something about it. Journalists, you guys put everyone in this moral quandary by choosing to publish the leak. So was that best for cycling? And before anybody, I think, gets all shouty and up in my grill here saying, no, Chris Froome put us in this position, we need to acknowledge that, in fact, it's the test.
At this point, we don't know.
Yeah, it's the test that's put us in this position. It's not yet been established that Froome has done anything wrong or was cheating or so on and so forth. I mean, the conclusion of the investigation will surely give us that. Next up, because you mentioned...
Oh, God.
I did say this was going to take a bit of time, mate. If David Lepartien is to lecture on what's best for cycling, would it have not been better to just say no comment and ask that everyone do the same so that the investigation can play out? And speaking, actually, of Monsieur Lepartien, why is no one asking why the first major story of this new presidency is the leaking of a test that, under the regulations, had no right to be public? Yeah. Am I the only one that's thinking cui bono here?
I mean, it's interesting. Lepartien, more and more, I mean, we had the grey grocer, Mr. Cookson, and prior to that, we had Cheeky Pat.
Oh, bring back Pat.
No, seriously, bring back Pat. Actually, I was looking back on Pat's record and I've decided I'm going to withdraw my support from that particular campaign. But Lepartien did feel like a chance. You know, he felt like the possibility of a breath of fresh air, maybe even taking benefit of his, you know, obvious links with, you know, ASO and the like. But what's become clear is he's nothing more than a publicity whore. You know, he will opine on anything under the sun. He seems to forget he's in charge of an organisation that can actually influence the sport, not just ask people to do stuff on a voluntary basis. I've got very little faith in Lepartien already, and we're only, what, a few months after his installation as president. Mm. So, you know, I was talking to Killian last week. You know, when we started, we were talking about the UCI's ineptitude. It got to a point where one year we actually decided we weren't going to talk about the UCI. Remember that? Mm. I'm not going to talk about the politics. It's boring me, so it must be boring our listeners. Here we are, 9 years after we started podcasting, and we're still talking about the same old crap. Yeah, stuff might have got marginally better in other places, but Lepartien strutting about like a cockerel, you know, mouthing off about to all and sundry about what would be best for cycling. Mate, you're the president of the UCI. You're capable of changing the rules for what is best in cycling. Concentrate on that instead of the sound bites.
And moving on then, if race organisers are going to argue on the grounds of what's best for cycling, I think they wouldn't be taking an event to one of the most contentious regions on the planet.
Aye, didn't get the moral high ground to me, Giro folk.
Also, is it best for cycling that RCS gave Bardiani CSF a wildcard to their highest profile race, but are still going to demand a guarantee over the result of their race regarding Chris Froome's situation? Other riders, if they're claiming a moral high ground and suggesting it would be right for cycling, best make sure they themselves or the teams that they ride for are beyond moral reproach. I mean, this all may sound like what-if-ery, but the tenet of this argument is on morality, which is based on principles with respect to right or wrong conduct. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as the Christians would have it, not that I am one, like he without sin, etc., etc. And I think, honestly, the reason I'm going for all this is, in playing devil's advocate, the question that hasn't been asked here, and until such times as Froome's guilt has been declared, this question remains entirely valid, is what's best for Chris Froome? Froome clearly believes he's innocent, otherwise he wouldn't be fighting this. And he thinks there is an explanation for what happened.
Well, he has a hell of a pair of swingers, as the Aussies say.
Well, that's equally valid. Why would he self-suspend if his personal moral compass is pointing to, look, I've done nothing wrong here? Again, salbutamol is a specified substance. He has the right to an investigation and explanation. And if, God forbid, it would appear, Froome provides an explanation which satisfies the case arbiter and he is cleared, would it be fair that he loses the race programme that he and his coach feel they need to obtain his season's objectives? I mean, this argument for self-suspension is based, you have to conclude, on the presumption of guilt, i.e. he'd affect race outcomes only to be banned at a later date. Therefore, the corollary based on the presumption of innocence, is the season should self-suspend until the case is resolved. That way, Froome won't be denied the opportunity to affect the outcome of races. So cast in that light, both arguments are utterly ludicrous, and we should countenance neither.
It's an interesting point. I mean, it's my major complaint about the whole thing is it makes our job hard. I don't care about any of the other stuff.
Okay, yeah, sorry, because, I forgot that the third thing we need to then consider is what's best for John Galloway?
That's the only thing you need to consider, mate. Now forget all the rest of the crap. I've tried to avoid talking about this on Twitter, although, of course, it comes up, and I really envied the fact that you've withdrawn from that particular arena on some occasions. But the problem is, we both cycling and Chris Froome are now in a no-win situation. You know, if Froome has been doing massive mileages in South Africa to try and duplicate, you know, the strains upon the body of a Grand Tour, for example, and can't come up with a decent explanation, then he'll be sanctioned. And, you know, I'll support that sanction fully, you know, because some woolly kind of middle ground won't satisfy anybody. The problem is non-woolly middle grounds, where he's sanctioned or he's exonerated, one or the other, now won't satisfy anybody either. You know, for Froome, all of this is almost irrelevant in terms of his legacy. You know, he's going to carry on racing. As you say, if his own moral compass indicates that he's done nothing wrong, he's going to feel really aggrieved at the end of his career. There is now going to be an asterisk, whatever happens and however fair or unfair that is. So my big argument isn't so much whether he should be suspended or not. It's the attitudes of the people observing it. You know, we've talked about this before. As cycling fans, I think we need to move on from, you know, the tribal judgment that I think we've seen so, you know, so often, and I've been guilty of it as well. You know, it's part of the fun of sport. But if all we can do is underpin the thing with, you know, chicanery and doping and, you know, all of that, it takes so much joy out of the sport that, you know, we do this because we're passionate about it. We do this because we care about the sport. But that's the drip, drip, drip I was talking about at the start, is this kind of thing going on without being properly resolved by the UCI or, you know, with the team dragging it out as is Killian's theory.
Let me address that one. Where is this coming from? Because people, I think where you're going for, and I'm sorry that I'm alighting on Killian here because that's unfair on Killian. But there, as far as I can see, has been absolutely no reason to hang your hat on that hook labelled Team Sky and or Chris Froome are dragging this out. Where does that come from?
I don't think he's stating it as a fact. I mean, it's a theory, which is that the longer they drag it out, then the stronger their hand is, because the more implications there are if, you know, a sanction is laid against Chris, because he's done more stuff. I mean, it's as simple as that. So, I mean, Killian's theory is that it would be in the best interest to Team Sky to draw it out. But I'm not here to defend him. He's perfectly capable of doing that himself.
No, I meant the argument itself. It's not, as I say, addressed to Killian. It's, I can't understand why there seems to be this conclusion has been drawn that Team Sky are doing it simply because the case is dragging out. And that's to the benefit of Team Sky. It doesn't actually necessarily draw you or bring you to the conclusion that it is Team Sky that are drawing this out. Who knows how long it actually should take? This might be a relatively short period of time. We don't know.
It's took 9 months. So, I mean, we're still well within that.
Yeah, so where do you come to the conclusion that Team Sky are dragging this out?
No, I think the conclusion is that it's to their benefit, which I think it undeniably is. Whether they're the ones taking the action that, you know, they derive that benefit from, who knows? You're right.
Mm. Sorry, I interrupted you there. You were...
Yeah, and I've completely forgotten what I was talking about.
Shall we move on?
No, actually, I do remember what I was talking about. It's, you know, I jokingly say it's bad for podcasters because we have to talk about it, but it's bad for cycling fans too. You know, this constant undercurrent of suspicion is toxic. And it's got to the point where if we didn't make our living doing this, there have been times in the past few years, and I know the same's true for you because we've talked about it, where I would just walk away from the bloody sport. You know, I'm a fan of cycling. I'm not a fan of doping controversies. And, you know, just having to talk about them constantly for the last 9 years is, it gets tiring. You know, so imagine what it's like if you're living through this. It's a hellish thing. But, you know, if he starts at the root of Del Sol, we'll have to talk about it, and there will be the elephant in the room.
No, I will see. I think all of what I was saying above is that there necessarily shouldn't have to be an elephant in the room, because we're in a situation whereby there is no, you can't say there's either innocence or guilt. There is simply the unfortunate leaking of a test, which the rider, the athlete, has the opportunity to explain. If he can't do that, fine, then the suspension has to take place, the ban has to take place, and that's absolutely fine. That's as it should be. But what I'm saying is we can't indulge ourselves in this drip, drip, drip. Is he guilty? Is he innocent? Because we actually shouldn't know about this in the first place. And it's not fair either to cycling for us to do that, or indeed to Chris Froome, because the avenues of thought that are logic that we are launched down by indulging in such assumptions of guilt or innocence only lead to ludicrous conclusions, i.e. he should self-suspend, or indeed the season should self-suspend, to be fair to Chris Froome. It's ludicrous. Simply watch the race. If Froome wins it, if Froome loses it, it doesn't matter. It'll be a good race. We'll see what happens in the future. There's no point in the what-ifs and buts and maybes at this point. The guy's entitled to race, and I would say that of any rider. I keep coming back to this as an adverse analytical finding for a specified substance, not a banned substance. We need to see what the explanation is and whether the arbitrator is satisfied with that explanation. Until such times, just watch the racing. You'll be happier that way, if nothing else.
Yeah, good luck with it. I tell you whose fault it is. It's Team Sky.
I thought it was Lepartien's fault.
It's Lepartien's fault as well.
Okay.
Actually, all joking aside, the behaviour of the backroom boys in Team Sky is a big bit of this undercurrent. You know, so I'm not joking when I say they have to take some responsibility for the attitudes that we're seeing.
I think you're right. I think the reason that we're seeing so much ire as regards what is, again, you know, I keep trying to grasp on as tightly as I can to the real fact that this is an AAF for a specified substance.
And I don't know if you've mentioned that this episode.
I just thought I'd throw it in just in case, you know, because you forget what you said in the past few minutes. But I think one of the reasons why there has been so much time and effort and wailing and gnashing of teeth, as I put it earlier, regarding this situation, is it's a hangover from the whole British Cycling Team Sky Bradley Wiggins thing, where there was really no satisfactory outcome to that. And I do think that a lot of that angst and frustration over how there was nothing really forthcoming from that, there was no conclusion, no closure on any of it, has spilled over into this situation with Chris Froome.
You've been off Twitter too long.
Yeah, that's it. I need to get more foamy at the mouth and right, moving on. Acting merely as a neat reminder that the Dubai tour starts tomorrow, and that in order not to miss any of the action, you need to set your alarms for 2 minutes before each stage is due to finish, comes the news that new manager at Cofidis, Cedric Vasseur, has decided to reduce the lead-out train afforded to Nasser Bahani. Vasseur denied the rumours, though, that this was due to other members of the squad not wanting to ride anywhere near Bahani in the final throes of a sprint.
I thought Vasseur was actually quite harsh on poor Nasser Bahani. There was almost an element of, you know, we know you've caught stuff up in the past, so you better watch your game, lad. And I think that's perfectly valid, because we have seen him, you know, cook up loads of stuff in the past, whether it's punching people the day before the Tour de France or taking lines that look like some weird, weird deviation on a minor country road in the last 50 metres of a sprint. Cofidis, we keep forgetting they exist other than Nasser Bahani, so I think they actually have to value Nasser a fair bit. And I don't know if it's the right move to, you know, to reduce the amount of support that he gets. But I can kind of understand where Vasseur's coming from, because Bahani's his own worst enemy so often, isn't he? And maybe, you know, taking some of that pressure off him and leaving him to do his own job in the run-up to the finish without committing the entire team to him will mean that Cofidis pull off a few more victories and don't just put all their eggs in one basket.
I think if this had been anyone else, any other sprinter other than Nasser Bahani, we could be maybe looking at this in a different light. I'm just reminded of that conversation we had several months ago regarding whether the sprint train itself was a relic from another time.
Yeah, or a very reduced sprint train.
Exactly that. And I think, as I say, had it been anyone else but Buchanan, who does have this reputation for all the things that you mentioned, we might have been looking at this as actually quite clever thinking from Cedric Vasseur and not maybe a bloody hell, you're a maniac. I'm not putting any more resources than are strictly speaking necessary at your disposal. So we'll see how this pans out. Actually, we'll see from tomorrow onwards. As I say, he's set to start at the Dubai Tour, which is, as we know, a sprinter's race.
To a certain extent, it's already worked for Cofidis because, you know, they use Laporte strongly in support of Nasser Buchanan. And he, you know, on his own managed to win a stage of the Étoile du Passage that we talked about earlier, you know, relieved of the responsibility of guiding the errant one towards the line. So, you know, maybe Cedric Vasseur's onto something.
Finally this week, and sticking with the French squad, Cofidis have announced a late, and it has to be said, a very welcome addition to their ranks. Former Dimension Data rider and Maillot à Pois wearer Daniel Tekla-Haimanot was in real danger of being without a contract this year, but the Eritrean has finally found a saddle for 2018 and will make his debut for Cofidis at the aforementioned Dubai Tour, which of course is the logical place to send a climbing specialist.
Actually, I've got nothing to say about this other than well done. I was really, distraught's too strong a word, but I was very, very upset at the prospect of not having Daniel Tekla-Haimanot in the peloton for the biggest races this year. And whilst Cofidis, you know, it almost feels like a step down from Dimension Data, let's be honest, it is, at least we're going to see the Eritrean riding on the roads of Europe and, you know, further afield like Dubai in the 2018 season. It would have been an absolute sin if we'd lost them.
Well, it's an absolute guarantee to the Vuelta, for example. You know, Cofidis are always going to get a wild card there, arguably the Tour as well. So, I mean, I genuinely think you were backing off the word distraught, but I genuinely thought that the Dimension Data kind of blotted their copybook somewhat by letting Tekla-Haimanot go. Yes, he's had a difficult time there on some occasions, and looking at the story at Cycling News, the writer was quite right to point out how, you know, Daniel Tekla-Haimanot's racing palmares has been adversely affected by simply getting visas for Eritrean riders. That's not his fault, but when you're a DS looking at whether this rider has done well over the past seasons and see he's not been at that many races, you start thinking, should I be investing in this guy? I think that totally overlooks the talent that the guy has, and also it may not mean much to DSs, but it sure as hell means a lot to both fans and sponsors. Daniel Tekla-Haimanot is great value for money. I think it's a foolish DS that overlooks him, and I'm going to look squarely at Dimension Data, as I say, who did the wrong thing in letting him go, and I'm really, really pleased to see that he does have a pro contract, which will see him in really big, you know, key events this season.
When I think about Dimension Data, I think about two riders. I mean, obviously in greater depth, I think about a lot more than those two, but the two that really strike me that have helped raise the profile are Mark Cavendish and Daniel Tekla-Haimanot. You know, he's such good value, he's such a thrilling climber to watch that I completely agree with you. It was mad that we weren't going to see him anyway, but now we are, so, you know, all's well in the world. And, you know, he'll take our mind off Nasser Buchanan for a wee bit.
Unfortunately, just playing that mental knee-jerk reaction that you do by mentioning certain riders, Daniel Tekla-Haimanot's name is unfortunately ever to be associated with. See, you know where I'm going. Carlton Kirby eating testicles.
Yeah, absolutely. I knew as soon as you said it. Yeah, that's an image I didn't want in my head. Thank you. Well done.
Sorry. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you so much for joining us as we chewed over the conversational cud of pro cycling. And we hope that you can join us again soon as we burp up more topics in the next edition of The Velocast.